to AWARE. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Good afternoon and welcome to the AWARE Show. I am Lisa Garr and I am so excited to be here today. Thank you so much for joining me. I want to invite you to check out our website, theawareshow.com. You can check out all things AWARE on there. We broadcast 5 other platforms here and on Hay House Radio and Gaia TV, and it's all on there. So you can see videos. If you like hearing our show on radio, you can also see video interviews on our Gaia TV show, and so much more is all on there. So check that out. And there's a great community site there where you can have access to all of our archives as well. So it's a cool place. Cool place to go for transformational media. Now, that is one of our topics today. And one of the, I just can't think of a better person to speak about transformational media than Jeremy Kagan. He is pretty much at the hub of it. And he is not only directed 11 feature films, including this year's show, a movie called Shot, and it's about gun violence. We're going to be talking about that today. He's also an Emmy TV award-winning director, as well as a tenured professor at USC's Cinematic Arts School, and it's just incredible. He's written about his near-death experience. He's made movies about USO. He practices Kabbalah right there in the center of it all. Jeremy, thanks for joining me.
It's truly my pleasure. I appreciate your show so much and all the offerings you give us.
Thank you. It is my joy, right? We are on this journey together.
Truly.
It's almost like, tell me if you feel if this is true. You can't not do it, right?
Yeah. You know, there was this thing, I heard this, Henry Ford, who I wouldn't use as an example of that much, except for his incredible productivity, but he did have this wonderful line. He said, if you think you can or if you think you can't, you're right.
Yes, exactly. It runs through you, and if you try to do anything else, it will course correct you back to it.
Truly.
For some reason, but we're on this journey together. And so tell me about your beginning and how you started on this transformational media train, because that's really what you are, as a storyteller. And yeah,
I'd say that for me, I come from a tradition of storytellers. I guess we all do. All our cultures have stories. And I grew up with a clergyman father and a teacher, and so stories were part of the way we grew up. And I think the transformative nature of understanding how powerful they are was a kind of slow development. But I noticed that when somebody tells you a story about what happened to them versus gives you lots of facts, it's the story you remember. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I began to look at the idea that the most powerful ways to influence me and potentially for us to influence others were to be able to get a story where we identify with whoever the story is being told about so that we experience that situation. And then we potentially have the choice to behave in a way maybe different from the way we initially started. So I feel like that's been part of, I guess, the history of mankind.
True. It's always been around. Transformational storytelling has always existed. Yes. You just have a way of putting it into a bigger or a different platform. It went from the fireplace to the, you know, campfire, I mean, to now you've got it on the media.
To another fireplace, if you think about it. It's light coming at us all the time. You know, what's so wonderful is there is a truth. It's sort of the metaphor is a powerful metaphor if you think about it. The light from a projector represents in many ways the light that in fact is the pure truth. And then there's lots of sort of veils that sort of block that light and get defined. And those veils sometimes can be so dense that we can't get to the truth. But sometimes there are these openings, and that, I think, is what the stories sometimes allow us. They allow us an opening. We did an experiment, which was quite amazing, actually, a number of years ago. I run something called the Changemaking Media Lab at USC, and the assignment was to see what's more effective. If you want to tell a story about a specific subject, for example, gun violence, which is what the dramatic movie I just did shot is about, if you want to tell a story about an idea and influence potentially awareness, if not behavior change, which is more effective, making a movie that's a story or making a movie that's more of a documentary? So what we did is we took on an assignment from the National Cancer Institute to encourage women to take Pap tests in order to avoid cervical cancer. And we made a 13-minute, very powerful documentary about all the facts of why you should do that. And we also made a kind of comic drama about a family preparing for a quinceañera, talking about sex in the kitchen. Huh. And then these were shown, both movies were shown to women all throughout the Southern California area to see which was more influencing in making them potentially say they were going to take a Pap test and then actually do it. And in fact, the drama was statistically much higher in influencing behavior change, which means the story influences you more than the facts.
Mm-hmm.
So when I wanted to take on this issue that is an epidemic for our society, and most of them, your listeners, I'm sure, are aware how we're the most violent society with guns, you know, 20 times any other society in the world, with over, you know, 100,000 people a year being killed and injured. I mean, it's just absurd. We've had, since 1970, 1.4 million Americans have been killed by gun violence, and that's more Americans killed by Americans than in all our wars combined since the American Revolution.
And that also includes suicides as well.
Absolutely. But that's
which is a whole other issue.
You know, but, and truly. And in fact, 60% of gun violence is, in fact, suicide because of the availability of guns.
Mm-hmm.
But the point being that these are numbers. And what do the numbers do? I mean, for some of us, the numbers influence us. But if you actually sit with somebody who's been shot and hear that story, that totally changes your relationship. It's like, you know, there used to be, before the sort of more acceptance of GLBT queer existence, it used to be that the thing that they found out sort of statistically was if a human being who was sort of prejudiced against queer people met three people who declared themselves in that world and realm, and actually engaged in conversation,
mm-hmm.
it totally changed the way they felt about it. So it's that the
right.
story provides the possibility of the human contact.
To go beyond the label and to go beyond the statistic. Now, if you could get a documentary that tells a story, or some of the best movies are, quote, based on a true story, then it attaches you in a different way.
Absolutely. And I think that some of the best documentaries actually do that. In fact, they become stories about people that we care about.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know what's going to happen to them, and we want to know what's going to happen to them, and that gets us involved. And we identify with them, and that also can change our behavior.
Well, I mean, there's so much happening these days that story documentaries can be made about. I mean, look at these kids in this parkland from Parkland. They are phenomenal. They are changing the world, and they are bringing awareness. It's almost like a storytelling documentary right in front of our eyes on these, with these marches and the, you know, using social media for good. And, you know, you could just do such an incredible piece on that. I noticed that, well, let's talk a little bit about your movie shot, and then there was an article in the LA Times about it and how it relates to Parkland, right?
The thing about the movie itself is that what I wanted myself to experience, and therefore I wanted the viewer to experience, what does it really mean to get shot? I mean, I honestly, as a movie maker, I've shot a lot of people. you know, I've really shot people on TV. I've shot people in the theaters. I'm part of the, in many ways, the responsible/irresponsible nature of movie making.
Interesting.
It becomes part of our storytelling devices. Somebody gets shot. But usually what happens when we see those movies is there's this cutaway to another scene. And then we might cut back to them and where they are. And then we cut away to another scene. And I actually wanted to know, when someone gets shot, what happens in that first hour? And it turns out it's called by the medical profession the golden hour. If you get shot and survive that hour, the likelihood is you will live. How you will live, that can be a big question.
Mm-hmm.
But that hour is crucial. So I wanted us to actually literally experience it. So the story tells the story of a person who is an innocent bystander who gets shot. And we're with him. Noah Wiley plays the part, and I think quite brilliantly.
Really well. Mm-hmm.
For an hour. And the minute should this horrible experience happen to any of us, you know, there you are on the ground waiting for the arrival of the police and the ambulance. And they don't come right away. What happens to you? What do you do?
And
what's your body feel like? What's your physical experience? What's your emotional? What's your spiritual experience? And then when they finally arrive and put you in that vehicle, you know, it isn't immediately you're taken to the hospital. There's a ride. It takes 6-7 minutes in L.A. And what happens to you in that place? And, you know, the idea that you may very well die. And how do you deal with that idea? And if you've never thought about your death, you know, and what do you deal with the pain? And those, that, you know, in the ambulances, they don't actually totally put you under because they want to make sure that you can deal with what's going on physically. That may not happen in removing your pain for a longer time.
Wow.
So we tell all of this story, and we never cut away. We're always with our character. In fact, we even in cinematographically take the point of view of this character. So the viewer goes through the experience emotionally, physically, psychologically, and spiritually about what it would mean to be shot. And I feel like it's another tool awakening us to what we become numb to and accept that as norm, that the idea there should be 100,000 people killed or injured each year. We accept that as norm. I mean, in our phone conversation, I was just figuring this out, there's like 96 people killed every single day. That means by the time we finish this conversation, 4 people will have been shot and killed and at least 8 injured.
Those are the ones that are reported. Yeah.
That's correct.
Right.
So, you know, I wanted this movie to really be another tool in the conversation. In fact, what we're doing right now is communicating to all the Parkland kids as well as everybody who's organizing, saying, use this movie, show this movie, talk about it. For example, UCLA on April 18th, and everybody who's listening is invited at 7:30 at Dodd Hall is going to show the movie, and there's going to be a panel discussion with people who've been shot to talk about what this all means.
Wow.
So we keep the conversation going.
There's a free screening?
Yes, it is.
That's very cool. Well, yeah. Now, one of the things that is a wonderful cinematic tool is the split screen in your film, is that you stay with the victim the entire film on a split screen, even though you've got the dramatic happenings of the other characters in the movie. And that was an interesting choice. Was that intentional for us to carry through with him and not leave him?
It was absolutely to be able to stay with him, but I also wanted to stay with the shooter. In this case, the shooter's a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Kid, you know, has a gun to protect himself from being bullied, and the gun accidentally goes off. So what does the kid do? How does he deal with this? And in this case, the kid happens to be an ethnic minority, which makes it even worse because, you know, are they going to believe him when he says it's an accident? And, you know, he doesn't, he thinks they might, but when he finally is in the presence of his mother, and she says, absolutely not, you're not going in there because they're not going to believe you at all. So we're dealing with lots of subject matters here. And I wanted us to experience that, too, at mm-hmm. the same time. And
mm-hmm.
as with most of us, I don't know, most of us are multitaskers now. We can watch TV and be on our computer and be on our phone all at the same time. So I felt like we can have 2 stories happening at the same time and actually absorb them. And in a way, it's like we're all connected anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted us to understand that, you know, the shooter and the person who gets shot, they're all connected. You know, those of you who are hearing this may have read the Gita, and there's this great confrontation between Arjuna and Krishna, and Krishna is literally saying to Arjuna, the person who kills and the person who is killed, they're the same.
Yes.
I wanted us to experience that.
That is very interesting. Yes, you have all these incredible perspectives, and you bring in these different aspects to this. Now, let's talk about, in the movie in itself, it's where is it available? Is it on Amazon right, now?
Right now it's on Amazon.
Okay.
It's on playing on Showtime as well, and it's on iTunes. But we're also making it available to high schools and colleges now to screen in in anywhere they'd like, because, as I said, one of the weird things, and maybe you had the same experience, when the March for Our Lives was in the news, it was an amazing experience to be in the streets of Los Angeles, where I was, and obviously people all around the country and the world, saying gun violence has got to something we've got to stop. But the next day, the news cycle was all about Stormy Daniels. So the idea of being able to keep the issue in our consciousness so that we potentially can shift our awareness and even our actions, that's what I would like this movie to be used as.
Well, it's
so that
it's always going to be like that, though, Jeremy. I mean, right now I'm watching the Mark Zuckerberg trial, and it's in Congress, and it's fascinating to me to how little these Congress people know about social media, yet they're trying this man who created it out of his garage. I mean, it's really fascinating to see how he handles it and how Congress handles it, and it's a documentary right there. But there's a lot of things that will take our attention that are very interesting. I do, following this Emma Gonzalez as obsessively, I'm in love with this child who's had this passion in her to keep this in the news and in the media and make an impact every time she utilizes that valuable screen time. And she's brilliant at it and at 17. So I really think that it's up to, people like us in the media to keep those stories in in the difference-making category, because it's life, and it appeals to our multitasking ability to go from story to story, and it's okay.
Yep.
So what can we do with this topic here? Now, is there a difference, by the way, between gun violence and gun control?
Well, let's put it this way. We have to understand on lots of levels what we're really sort of talking about. I mean, there are 300 million plus guns already in the United States. Again, there's going to be some numbers here. And the fact is that 70% or more of our citizens don't have guns. And it's only around 3 or 4% that actually own 50% of all the guns, which is really bizarre when you think about it. And people who are in the National Rifle Association, NAR, over 70% of those people believe we've got to be having much more regulation in terms of gun usage and ownership. They already believe in that as well. So, but it's strange, who gets the voice? Who screams the loudest? Who do we listen to the most? And that's a whole issue we're always confronting. And I think one of the, if you will, psychic phenomena that we need to deal with is asking the question, why are we so violent with our guns? Uncomparable to anywhere else in the world. Why us? You know, Canadians own guns. Australians had mass murders, and what they did is they got rid of all their automatic weapons. They actually did it. They said, these are wrong. People shouldn't be having assault rifles. We're not in assault. We're not assault.
But they have much smaller populations to be able to influence. Not here.
You know, I guess, you can talk about numbers too, but, I mean, I think it's an attitude. And the question is, is this really about security or is this about fear?
Well, America's a very fear-based country. It's obvious.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
And how do we shift that? Because, one way, where I travel in America, south, north, I find Americans incredibly engaging.
Yes.
Sharing, open, caring. I mean, that's I think who we really are. Now, maybe other countries and cultures are like that too, but that's who we are. And yet there's some overlay of fear that motivates this idea that we have to have these things to protect us. And there's something that I've been thinking about for a while, and that's the psychic phenomena about how this particular country got started. And we're so young. A lot of people say, you're an adolescent country. You're 300 years old. England's 1,000 years old.
Right,
right. So we're kind of in an adolescent state of mind. But one of the things that's been hitting me as I've been thinking about this subject is that, those guns from those Europeans who came over and confronted the first peoples and killed them are how we got started. and slavery, which was North and South, and built the industries of America. It was guns that took those people and put them on boats. We have this responsibility psychically as Americans to really confront this. And it's hard. You don't want to feel guilt or shame. Who wants that?
I want to actually retract what I said. America tends to be a fear-based country because of what you're talking about, because of a lot of our laws and a lot of our history is based on that. But what you and I are here to do is change that conversation to a love-based country and a kinder country, because, yes, so much of what is perceived and what's been written and what our laws were written on and the Constitution really was based on that level of fear and control. And so love has been in the conversation, but it hasn't been the guiding factor.
And yet we hear in one of our documents the pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. I mean,
pursuit, like it's never going to happen. It's always going to be the pursuit. Yeah.
Well, we all know that happiness goes and comes. But, I was thinking about a year ago, I got to be in the presence of this rather wise guru named Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. Mm-hmm. And I asked him the questions, what do you do with fear? And he kind of giggled at me. And he held his hand out and he had his thumb down. And he said, fear, and then he turned his thumb up in the up position, is just the inverse of love. And
nice.
I've been sort of, what is that? And I've been sort of struggling with that on one level. And I get that in a way, the love part says that we're all really connected, that we depend on each other, that we want to be connected, that we seek that connection. And the opposite of that is pushing that away. And that's why, in a way, there's a connection to be wanting to connect it and being afraid.
Well, it's part of nature, though. It's law of physics. It's equal and opposite reactions. It's the shadow. It's present everywhere.
Mm.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling that sometimes the thing that we fear, when we confront it, sometimes transforms itself and is no longer that. I remember once hearing the story about, should you kill demons? And this particular version was, no. Yeah, so trap the demon, tie him up, and then teach them the Dharma, teach them consciousness, teach them awareness until they say, okay, I get it. I'm not going to be a demon anymore. So the idea that you can transform fear by actually confronting it and then realize that in a way it is the opposite in terms of connected, and you move past it and through it.
You could say that love is just fear with consciousness. You wrote a book about your near-death experience, and I want to ask you about this because a while ago, it's an e-book now, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yeah.
I'm looking for the title. What is the title?
It's called My Death, A Personal Guidebook.
Okay.
And it's actually through Hayes Press, interesting enough, from Balboa.
Hayes, cool.
Press. Yeah.
So in the description of your NDE, you imagine hell.
Mm-hmm.
Which is so interesting and relevant to the conversation we were just having, because you had seen the worst of it and you realize that it is something that it's all in our imagination. Is that what you realized?
Yeah. I kind of grew up, as I said, my father was a clergyman, and his attitude about heaven and hell were these things were just human creations, that was not really the truth. In fact, they, to some degree, creations by the church that had become so sort of, I'll use the word, corrupted, that it was interested in being in control and having authority as distinguished from being, let's say, the idealization of what Christ was putting out, and creating the idea of punishment, or creating the idea that your suffering here is a entrance into the heaven of bliss that you will go to so you can endure your suffering, sort of in many ways is a diversion from awareness and from change. So that's what I kind of grew up with. But, you know, as a person who was getting educated, I, you know, saw the paintings of hell and Hieronymus Bosch and, you know, read Dante and got all those images. So that was part of my consciousness as well, even though I was sort of told that they were man's making, human making, rather than the creator's making. Okay. So in this near-death experience, or I like to even call it now through-death experience, the point at which I'd already lost total, I wouldn't say control, I'd lost all my senses, meaning that I could feel nothing, I could see nothing, I could hear nothing. I literally, all of that was gone and dead. Yet I was still conscious. And the transition, which was, by the way, blissful front transition from the terror of I'm dying to actually the dying itself, was so serene and peaceful that I was having this incredible sort of ecstatic experience. And I was still conscious. I realized that my body was dead, but I was still in some form of consciousness, and I was still form some form of the word I. And in this blissful state, I wondered literally what was next. And when I asked myself the question, I thought, what if there is a heaven and hell? And then I thought, I guess, or my mind said, well, of course, you've not been the most saintly of beings, so if there is one, you know where you're going, and that's where I ended up. I ended up in my version of hell.
Oh.
And it was terrifying and disgusting, and there was also a creeping awareness that it was like watching a movie. It wasn't real. And when I realized it was just a image of or a set of images, it immediately dissolved. And I began what had many, many near-death experiences talk about this particular kind of journey. Mm-hmm. But that issue of realizing that the entire thing was kind of made up, and it's fascinating in terms of our discussion in the sense that we look at a movie and we believe it's happening. And we are right in it, and we have emotional responses to what's happening.
And they linger.
It's still a movie. We're totally involved in it, and it influences us, but it isn't the truth. It's interesting. Spielberg's newest movie ends with a line like, reality is better than any image that we can create, even if we create these spectacular worlds.
Is that Player One?
Yes, and it's wonderful that he sort of goes there because he's one of the greatest image makers
we've
ever had.
Well, I mean, it's when you take, like we talked about earlier, that storytelling documentary style. Like, I just saw Wonder on pay-per-view, and so many times I could watch that movie again and again and still cry because the moments were so tender and so real because they happen every day when someone is discriminated against and you feel the pain of that person and you want them to feel no pain. And then those tender, beautiful moments happen all the time. So that's why you feel that reality of that moment, and it's expressed beautifully through film. And you get that opportunity to make art with those moments, and you bring them to, you know, outside of us in such a beautiful way. I remember when I was taking a class at USC, and because I went there, and I remember it was something about the art of filmmaking, and it was about how we sit in a theater or when we watch a movie, these images and people and pictures and stories are bigger than life. And you go into this dream state, so you're really looking at this movie unconsciously, and it goes directly into the unconscious mind. So,
well spoken.
The art of movie watching is such a beautifully unconscious experience that you can let affect you if it's done in the right way. So you knowing that, get to create art with your films. And the fact that you also had a near-death experience, and that was, if I don't know if you'd mentioned that you were in a sweat lodge and it was a very rough experience for you and you almost died. This was a while ago. But you got to bring these moments, this this view into another part of your mind, into our cinematic experience, which I think is so great. Now, what do you do with it? Where do you go from here, Jeremy? What do you do now?
You know, it's like what I do now is have a good conversation with you. That's what I do now.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that it's, you know, it's the series of nows that we live that are the probably the most significant things that we offer each other, which means to increase one's consciousness and to be able to share and to be able to. And this was sort of one of the big lessons of my through-death experience, you know, because I didn't know anything about these things, and I had this experience, and now I was, you know, totally preoccupied with it, and I was meeting people left and right, talking
yes.
to people. I should have the Aware show.
It's the whole world.
You know,
yes.
I would have been listening right off the bat to every one of the Aware show that would have dealt with it. And the question came sort of like, you know, what do you do with it, right? And I remember finally seeing somebody, after seeing lots of people throughout this, and this particular guy looked at me and he said, meditate on a feather. I said, what?
Mm.
Meditate on a feather? And at that time, I wasn't into meditation. I am now. But I wasn't then. I said, and he could see the confusion on my face. He could see how I was, you know, desperate in terms of wanting to seek what I do now. What do I do next? And he suddenly smiled at me and he said, lighten up. And I realized as I sort of grabbed a hold of what he was saying was that's an incredibly good message for us. Because if you sort of resonate on lightening up, it's not taking your own personal life and all your suffering so seriously. That's a good one, to be able to have a perspective, you know, on your life that allows you to not be overwhelmed by the baggage that's physical and psychological. You know, to lighten up is to let go of a lot of heaviness that really can, and I'm heaviness even in terms of like the darkness about being a gun violent society. Even within that, can you still lighten up? And lighten up in the sense of, you know, literally be a light. You know, be
yes.
able to share things and be a beacon to show the way for yourself and for other people. That's lightening up. And lightening up is being passionate. You know, light, that light inside you, that passion, that fire that exists in every single one of us.
Yes. And I had the pleasure of speaking once at this organization. There's an association. It's an international association for near-death studies. It's mm-hmm. called IANS, and it's been around for 50 years.
Yeah.
And every year, are you familiar with this organization?
I am. I've actually spoken.
You have too.
And had an article written with them. It's an amazing group of people.
It is, and it's so incredible. They meet once a year, and wherever they choose to meet in a different area each time. And it's the stories that people speak about. They have an experiencer's room where you can just go sit, and it's a circle, and whoever wants to talk about their experience can just go in there and talk about it. And what I found in this beautiful common theme with all of these people who had experienced, the brink of death or been brushed so closely with death, it expanded their awareness.
Yep.
They became a different person. They changed their direction in life. They awaken to the possibility that there is more than just here and now. And there's, you know, maybe 10 or 12 different consistent characteristics that Raymond Moody speaks about, and he did
yep.
that brilliantly. But it really opens a different perspective in your brain or in your mind that other possibilities exist outside of our own. This is all filmmaking is perspective shifting.
I think the whole issue of how we perceive is really, it defines who we are. And oftentimes our perception gets limited by
mm-hmm.
what we've been told, limited certainly by fear. And the idea, I mean, the thing that we all must fear on one level is, of course, the unknown. And what's the biggest unknown? Well, for all of us, it's, you know, what happens when you die. That's the one. And every one of us will or is. And the idea that, in fact, death is part of life itself, that, yes, the sadness and grief of losing this particular life and your experiences, if you've been able to have one that's been blessed, as in many ways we all have. I mean, there's a wonderful line about the man who said, you know, when I came into the world, everybody was laughing and I was crying. And now that I'm going out of the world,
you're laughing.
And everybody's crying. Yeah. But the idea about death as not the end, but in fact part of the journey, and that's what those people who've been able to have these experiences and share them are reminding us of. You know, there's this wonderful line, if you die before you die, when you die, you don't die. If you die before mm-hmm. you die, which would be a near-death experience, when you die, which we're all going to do, you don't die.
You don't really die.
Because you realize that, in fact, there is this transition into another, quote, and I'm putting in a quote, experience, but it is also realization that consciousness itself never ends.
And then you get to pre-plan before you actually leave the body how you're going to connect back here with the loved ones around you. It's a really cool concept you can actually do if you change your perception about it all. Now, I do have a question for you about the alien aspect. You produced Roswell back in the day. This was 1994. Mm-hmm. And then you also, I was just reading, you directed Taken for Steven Spielberg about...
Mm-hmm. About the aliens as well.
As well. Yeah. What is your fascination with the alien community?
Well, I think it's the alien community got fascinated with me and went after me. In the sense that, you know, some incidents in our lives are not coincidences, probably no coincidences, but they feel like coincidences. Because I didn't, if you had asked me in a year before I made that movie, if you asked me what UFO stood for, I don't think I even knew.
Mm.
But it turned out that a colleague of mine that had gone to the American Film Institute, he and his children had actually had an experience where they had sighted one of these things and it changed them, and he'd gotten totally absorbed in this area, and he told me the Roswell story. And when I heard it, I thought, this is a terrific story, period. As a storyteller, this is a great story.
Ah.
So I was able initially to get HBO involved, and Showtime ended up making the movie with us. But there's this interesting sort of, and again, it's complex in the sense that we have certain, I want to say memes or modes or images or forms that help us to deal with the unknown. And it gives us even a kind of weird, strange security of the unknown. Because as you just said, in the perceptive process, if you realize, and by the way, this is Kabbalah, if you realize that you exist at this very moment, at this very second, in many, many, and I'll use the word, worlds, simultaneously. But most of us aren't aware of any of them. We're barely able to deal with the one we're dealing with, which is the physical world. But you exist on all these worlds all the time. And these other worlds, for example, the second one, which is called in Kabbalistic Hebrew, Yetzirah, which has to do with the world of formation. In this world, in order, this is sort of like the dream world, and we all, some of us have dreams, and some of those dreams are so realistic, we believe, in fact, that they actually are happening. That's like the heaven and hell issue. And we believe them. They're so powerful. And they're filled with imagery. And oftentimes that imagery is referencing something that we kind of already know in this world. So the depiction, for example, of aliens or alien spaceships, they're kind of like what we already somewhat know. And then they become these images that we can sort of say accept in some way. The alien has, for example, two eyes. Well, why would an alien necessarily have two eyes? How about the alien have 50 eyes? Right?
Or one.
Because we can deal with two eyes. So I feel like this is the way we get secure, by having some images that we reference that allow us to take the unknown and have it a little bit more, quote, secure. But there's this wonderful line that I'm sure you know about, you know, seeking freedom. And the idea of true freedom is having nowhere to stand. It's an amazing concept, having nowhere to stand, meaning that the unknown, the mysterious, the magical It's all here, and you don't have anything to grasp onto, to hold. But images allow us to grasp onto things. And so for me, the whole alien issue is really, we are in communication every millisecond with multiple, in quote, worlds. And we are being messaged by those other worlds. Whether you believe in souls or you don't, whether you believe in the idea of guardian angels or you don't, but this is really a, for me anyway, a truth in how some people can access it. You know, you've been in rooms where people see ghosts and they see them. Now, is it a ghost or is it the way that mind can form the unknown and allow it to have some kind of reality? And I believe that's something where the alien world is coming from.
Well, after we find that out, say with this question gets answered, we are not alone. And that question gets answered. Yes, we are not alone. And there are other beings and this planet and this earth and so forth. Say that question gets answered. Pentagon has helped us with this. Now what? Like, where do you go with that?
One of the things that, of course, would be, you know, when there's an outsider that is feared, the insiders unite, okay? So one of the ideas, and we've seen this now in things like that movie Arrival, and way back when the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still, again, here, using two movies, dealing with aliens, dealing with the idea that there, in fact, are literally in this time and space, other worlds that actually have intelligence and can communicate with us, because that's what both of those movies' example are. But both of those movies really are about, can you get your Earth act together? Can you realize that, in fact, you are all on this one remarkable planet, and that you have the capacity to create a, if you will, paradise on this planet? You can do it if you all unite together and overcome your fears of each other and realize that you're, in fact, all on this planet, this spaceship moving 600 miles an hour, that you can create something spectacular. But you needed the outside sort of like threat, in quotes, to allow us, for the insiders, to recognize we're all connected. So there is that idea that, you know, I just, if in fact the fantasy storytelling were to become real, it might help us recognize how we actually are interdependent and allow us to be aware of that and act on that rather than be selfish.
That can be an endless conversation, yes. That I understand why it continues on, and I see that with the Coast audience. The Coast to Coast audience is such a tribe of wonderful people who really truly unite on that great question and experience of we are not alone. It's a good one. Now, let me ask you about your teaching and your being a professor at USC. In your classes, do you challenge your students with solving some of these problems, or is it how to bring awareness and cinematic awareness to the world?
One of the classes that I teach with some of my colleagues is called Media for Social Change.
Uh-huh.
And so the students who are taking these classes are invited to take on a social issue that they're concerned with and then use the cinematic media to either do one of two things. One is to change people's awareness. In other words, I didn't know that all of these dolphins were being killed in this particular space. So now I know this, and my awareness has changed. Or I didn't know what the life of somebody living in the mountains in the steppes in Mongolia is like. Now I know. And maybe it allows me to not only sympathize, but potentially empathize. So that's one area. And then the other area is actually to change people's behavior. Much more challenging and difficult, because how do you do that?
Right.
How do you watch a piece of cinema, whatever it is, whether it's a VR piece, whether it's a documentary, or whether it's a dramatic or a comic piece? Can any of those actually get people to change behavior? And what are some of the methodologies? And one of the things we study is, and then make movies about this, is certain methodologies, particularly in the way that people can identify with certain characters that are facing a conflict and if that conflict allows them to choose, well, I see the guy who won't do anything, I see the girl who will do something, and I see the person who's stuck in between and can't make up his or her or their mind. And taking those three kind of characters and seeing who I identify with as the viewer, see if, oh, wait a minute, that's not characters making choices, maybe I could make that choice too. So we're still in discovery process because, you know, a lot of movies are made that do want us to change our behavior, and certainly the entire advertisement business is all about changing behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
What's fascinating about them, when you talk to these people who study how images and sound change people's minds, they say that half of the money that they invest in advertisement is wasted because it doesn't work. Mm. So this issue of studying this and experimenting with and going through the process of making these pieces is what we're encouraging these students who take these Media for Social Change classes here at USC. That's what they do.
So they study how sound and story and lighting and all those cinematic aspects actually can create behavioral change.
Absolutely. And there's no science to this yet. I mean,
there
is, as I said, there is a kind of theory that has been written about that has to do with certainly the idea of identification and what's called transportation. It's strange that that's the word that the sociologists use, but it has to do with you're identifying with a character who makes a certain number of choices, and those choices, because you've identified with that character, you are willing to make as well. And so that sometimes influences behavior. Sometimes the choices are what hat you're going to wear, but you know, other times it actually makes you a little bit more conscious.
If you go a little deeper and you look at archetypes, and then you can find different archetypal characters like the superheroes do, or then people can identify with those archetypes, and it does change their behavior because the archetype makes decisions. If they identify with the archetype, then that person makes a decision, and then they can also follow that behavior. But how about when you look at something like gun violence, and you look at this person's, in your specific movie, shot, that had the experience of, I don't want to spoil the movie, but had an interesting experience from being the victim.
Right.
And then had a transformation at the end of the movie.
Right. One of the things that and this is one of the questions that we look at in certain stories. Certain stories have what we call a closed ending, meaning that there's a problem, there's conflict, the problem gets solved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And other stories, there's a problem, there's conflict, and the problem doesn't quite get solved. In fact, when you leave the theater, you're going, or turn the, you know, away from the television, you're going, I wonder what happens next.
Yeah.
Just like you asked me, you know, what do you do next?
Like Three Billboards.
What happens next exactly means that you have to ask the question, if you were in this situation, what would you do?
Right.
And that makes you, to some degree, more of a participant in the issue.
Mm.
So that's one of the things we work with some of these students. Do you want your piece to be closed, meaning that, you know, here's the problem, you get exposed to this social issue, climate change, and how difficult it is, and then you have a solution, and it's done? Or do you say, here's the problem, gun violence is an epidemic in this country. You tell a story that gets you involved in it, and at the end of that story, the ending is open, meaning that it isn't, you didn't solve it. And that means that I need to, as the viewer, consider this and, you know, really think about this. And, you know, maybe should guns be less available to people? I mean, I just heard something 2 days ago that was so sad. The states in which there are less gun control, more police people are killed.
Hmm. Yeah, it's definitely a debatable topic. That's why we go back to the mental illness issue. And there are a lot more programs that I've seen start to get created as a result of what we're seeing with the gun violence. Maybe they've already always been in existence, and they're getting more attention or maybe more funding or getting reinstated. That part about the gun violence is a hard one, but the mental illness is something that we can start with.
Yeah, I guess I would not emphasize that. I feel like from the work that I've been reading from people who actually are thinking about this, that's not the issue. The issue, I mean, we may be a mentally ill society and have our own problems, but the issue really is very specific to the availability of guns and the fact that we don't make it more challenging and responsible for some people to get guns. And, you know, just like you look, I mean, there's so many, it's so obvious now. You get a driver's license because you prove yourself able and capable of driving the car. You get a gun because you just bought it.
Right.
And you can be
mentally ill.
But the work that people are dealing with now that it's being studied is it's not the issue of a few people who are mentally ill. It's the issue of guns being way, way too available. And we can change that. And I think, you know, gun owners want people to be responsible with guns. Most gun owners are incredibly responsible with their guns. But the idea that it's still so easy to get, and what's really good, and my admiration for these young people who really have the not only the idealism but the wherewithal to step up and show up and even guide us, and even in their innocence guide us, because there's just no reason for the logic to explain why we have this incredible amount of gun violence, why, you know, seven of those killed today are going to be children or teenagers, seven today. I mean, it's just wrong, and we as a society can take it on. So for me, the issue becomes, sort of locally what we do. Unfortunately, the federal system at this particular moment is so cumbersome and
right. I
owned
mean,
and so, you know,
I was
everybody's
just...
rich, you know. I mean, every single one of those people who's in the Congress are rich, rich people answering to rich, rich people.
I was going to say that. You can spend all this time with Congress trying to regulate Facebook, but how much time is Congress spending on trying to regulate gun control?
Yeah,
it's paid for at this point. Yeah.
Exactly. But locally, we can do things. Local cities are doing every single day. I mean, there are cities in Florida now are doing things that are just saying, you can't carry a gun onto a high school campus. I don't care if the state suddenly says you can. You're not going to do it here. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, you know, people are saying locally we can be responsible, and I feel that that's where change happens. The change happens is within your house. Change happens within in your local communities. And I believe that's the way change will happen within this particular issue. And, you know, I'm hoping that shot as another tool for people to look at and discuss afterwards. And by the way, one of the things that we've learned also about the nature of media for social change, making cinema for social change, is it needs repetition.
Right.
You need to hear it again and again. Particularly in our time when you got so many diversions. So the more films and television shows and discussions and panels and blogs and vlogs that are about this, the more we're going to be able to become active within our own communities, and that's where change will happen.
What has the reaction to your film been?
Well, some people honestly are. It's difficult. There are people that have like been pretty devastated by it because it's such a it's in your face. You have to face what it means to get shot. What's nice is that it's just starting. In fact, even today, a couple high schools in the Midwest have asked to show the film to their students.
Oh.
So I feel
yes.
like this is again. It's just, and I don't mean to minimize it because it's a life's work here, but it's a tool. It's another thing for discussion, and it's a tool in which, you know, people who are gun owners can be participants in, because, as I said, you know, the 70% of the people in NRA know that there should be stronger background checks, and, you know, I think most Americans believe that assault rifles are not necessary to have in your home. The more we sort of get together, and as I said, on a local level, the more change is happening. And I think every day I'm reading about, on local levels, but with cities and some states, you're seeing change being offered and acted on. And, you know, as long as those students have the guts to be out there and keep going, I think they will inspire us to be responsible adults.
I hope that they do continue on now. I'm sure they will, and there's a lot of support around those students in Parkland. Now, how, if people want the movie shot to be screened at their school, how do they get in contact with you?
Well, there are two ways. There's a organization called Gather. It's spelled G-A-T-H-R, not E-R. And if you just type that in on your computer, it will lead you to getting access to the movie. The movie, actually, as we said, is also on Amazon and iTunes. So those are other ways to, and also Showtime. So those are another access to the movie. And I, you know, I'll repeat that on April 18th at Dodd Hall in at UCLA at 7:30, there's a free screening of the movie. So any of your listeners who would like to see it on a big screen, and I want to say this is now a cinema person talking.
Okay.
The experience on a big screen is different than experience on a little one.
Oh.
And so therefore, I highly recommend if you have the opportunity to see this movie and lots of other movies, like to see it on a big screen is, I think, much more, and if you will, involving. It takes more of your space. But anyway, it's playing on April 18th, which is a Wednesday at 7:30 at the Dodd Hall at UCLA. So you're invited to come see it.
Locally here in L.A. So otherwise, you can see it on Amazon, iTunes, and if you want to have it be shown in your school, you can go on Gather, which is great because they can arrange screenings in your own hometown and have discussions afterwards and so forth. There's a lot of great ways to be able to do that. Now, your this multi-talented aspect of you, you've had the e-book written, you've produced these incredible films and movies, you're a professor at USC, you have your hands in so many fun things. What do you really feel is, and we have about, you know, 3-4 minutes left, what do you really feel will make a difference in transformational media where it can actually become the norm and the mainstream in order to have transformation be a part of media?
Well, that's a wonderful question.
It's a big one.
And I think it's got two aspects to it. One aspect is us, the viewer. Are we wanting to have our media experiences that will guide us to expand who we are, or do we want them to be diversions from the suffering that we experience? And I think that's a choice that we have. And, I'm just as much a, if there's still couches, couch potato every now and then, as any other human being, where I want the media to divert me from deeper consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
That's my choice. But there are other times when I realize what I would like the media to do is not just to scare me, which is what news does these days. I mean, if you turn on any of the news shows, whether it's left wing or right wing, they're all about terrifying you. They're all about scaring you. So that's not conscious raising. That is, in fact, consciousness constricting. Mm-hmm. So the question now becomes, where do I want to have the experience of my the media that I experience, whether it's a painting or a piece of music or whether it's any kind of cinematic experience, allow me to have a wider perspective on who I am and who the world is. That's my choice. And the other choice is the responsibility of the image makers themselves. I mean, it's like Zuckerberg now talking about his responsibility in terms of what an amazing thing that he and his fellows have created. Do we have a responsibility? And I separate that, a responsibility. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they do. And that means that those of us who are media makers have the responsibility to also present transformative experiences for our viewers, audiences.
Yes.
Now, the biggest problem that at all that sort of surrounds, you have to acknowledge the issue of profit, why things are being made, and capitalism itself, which many times will influence how anything is put out there.
Yes.
In order to say that what we're doing this for is to divert you and to make you spend money.
Well,
not
yes.
necessarily to expand your consciousness.
Well, I will do one quick plug for myself on Gaia TV, which you can go GaiaTV.com. It is there's a toolbar on there, and it says, "What are you interested in?" It says topics, and they have noticed a spike in the topics that are related to my show on transformation, consciousness, connection, those types of things. So if you get an opportunity and if you want more conscious programming on Gaia TV, you can go in there and you can just put under the topics section inspiration or Lisa Gar or whatever it is, so that raises their data numbers to be able to see that conscious media is what you are wanting to see more of. And so it's just another way to mobilize an audience towards what Jeremy Kagan is talking about here, being us, the viewer, wanting to request what it is that we want to see more of. So that's a way to do that. If you want to also find out more about Jeremy Kagan, you can go to his, Amazon, iTunes, Showtime, wherever, and you can look up the movie Shot, S-H-O-T. And thank you so much, Jeremy. You have contributed so much to this world. I look forward to more.
I really appreciate your giving me the opportunity to have a conversation with you, Lisa.
I loved it. So take care. All right. I am Lisa Gar, and until next time, I invite you to stay aware.